This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later, we'll be talking about the X Prize and the future of space travel. But first, this week, there was a ritual that was practiced, dating back over 100 years, where a few select scientists around the world are awakened from sleep by a message from Sweden. It's actually the notification of the Nobel Prize, and it's this week, of course, for physics, chemistry, physiology, or medicine, the world's top science honors. And joining me now to talk about this year's awards is John Rennie, editor-in-chief of Scientific American magazine here in New York. Welcome back to the program.
Pleasure to be here, Ira.
Interesting selection this year?
Yes, certainly. I think it's an interesting combination of some work that's relatively new in terms of how relatively recent in terms of getting a Nobel Prize, and some other things that you could say, well, it's really overdue. I know I was kind of surprised in at least one case.
Let's talk about that. Which one do you think was overdue?
Well, I think the physics prize was the one that struck me, only in the sense that I was surprised that it hadn't received a Nobel Prize already. It's a really very important, very fundamental contribution to the understanding of physics.
And that involved what?
Well, what the researchers had done in this case was they made an important understanding of what's called the strong force or color force, which is one of the essential forces of nature, and it's really one of the most important things that physicists need to understand in their quest to try to pull all of the forces of nature together under one big unified theory.
And that's the force that holds.
That's right. The strong force is the one that holds together the quarks, the most fundamental particles of nature, and binds them together into the particles we know as protons and neutrons and that sort of thing. The strange thing about this strong force is that it behaves in a way that's completely different from, say, gravity or magnetism, the ones we have experience with.
Yeah.
Gravity and magnetism, the closer together the things are that are being acted on, the closer together they are, the stronger the force becomes. The Earth's gravity is tugging on me tighter than it is people up in the space station. But the strong force, the holding together the quarks, works exactly the other way. That is that the force becomes more and more pronounced the farther and farther the quarks get from one another. People often compare it to a rubber band. As the quarks move away from one another, this rubber band-like force stretches out and stretches out. So the quarks naturally want to couple together into these triplets inside the protons, and that's why you will never, ever find a quark floating around on its own.
Not yet.
Well, that's right.
I never say never in physics, right? It's the quantum world. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about the physics prize this in Nobel Prizes. We're going to talk about the other prizes with John Rennie of Scientific American. So you say, that was done 30 years ago? They
That's right. A lot of that work was back in
the 70s.
So that took
a long time, as you say, that something that was overdue.
That's right. And sometimes, traditionally, it was always the case, the Nobel Prize takes a number of years for the evidence to mount, for it to be recognized as the great contribution to science and the welfare of mankind that it is.
Mm-hmm. So they got the prize for describing how the quarks would...
That's right, describing this strong force and how it worked.
And, of course, the big enchilada is trying to get all the forces
exactly.
of nature together.
Exactly. The great quest of all physics is to someday be able to pull together the different individual theories for the strong force and the weak force and electromagnetism and gravity and unite them in something that sometimes used to be called the grand unified theory. These days people often just call it a theory of everything, which is a very grandiose name.
That's when the publicists came in. Took it over. All right, let's move on to another prize. Let's pick one out, chemistry.
Oh, chemistry,
this
sure.
This was an interesting one.
Yes, this is one that was pretty interesting because it points to how it is that your cells know how to tear apart their own old broken down proteins. Our bodies are in a constant state of flux. I look at you, Ira Flatow, and you look like the same Ira Flatow that you were yesterday, but at the cellular level, your proteins are constantly being turned over and your cells are living and dying. And in fact, a lot of diseases are caused by an imbalance in the rate at which proteins are being built and the rate at which they're being torn back down again. Mm-hmm. But for many years, it was a real mystery of how exactly does the cell know how to tear apart an old protein? How does it know to recognize that one protein is defective or that its time has come to be taken apart? And the researchers who won this year's chemistry prize were involved in recognizing how it is that those old proteins that were ready to be destroyed, how they get tagged, and basically that they get this kiss of death that tells them it's time to be taken to the recycling bin.
Mm-hmm. And there were, what, two Israelis and one American?
That's right.
Who shared in that prize. And they talked about, the citation said, for the discovery of ubiquitin mediated protein degradation. I mean, they speak in those words.
Yes, that is quite a mouthful. But the key to what they discovered was that the cell uses a protein that was for a long time people didn't know what this protein was for, because mm-hmm. when they looked at it in every organism above the level of bacteria, they found it every place, but they couldn't figure out what it was for. Well, it turns out because it was every place, they called it ubiquitin because uh-huh. it was ubiquitous. Uh-huh. And what these researchers discovered is that ubiquitin is the tag that gets attached onto these proteins and says, "Up, oh, your time has come."
So when you get tagged, you then get thrown into the
tag. You're it. At that point, you get dragged off to the cell's recycling center called the proteasome, mm-hmm. and the proteins get broken back down into their basic amino acids, and then those get reused to make brand new proteins.
And if something happens in that process, then we have disease that might occur?
There are a number of different types of diseases that do depend on that are caused by an imbalance of some sort. One thing that pops up a lot is cystic fibrosis is mm-hmm. one that often gets mentioned. Cystic fibrosis is caused by the fact that certain kinds of calcium channel proteins that are essential in your breathing passages, that these are defective, and so that these proteins get tagged and they get destroyed prematurely. They never get to the surface of the cells, mm-hmm. and as a result, people have the problems with breathing that they do.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there was a run of Nobels for Americans this year, and the next one in physiology or medicine were two more Americans.
That's right. It was two people, actually, some hometown boy here in New York. With Richard Axel,
right, Columbia.
That's right, and someone who Linda Buck, who was originally his graduate student, and it's interesting that they got they both won this work. They worked together for parts of it, and then they did other parts of it later on independently. They've been both collaborators and sometimes rivals in this whole area. But their work was aimed at understanding something we all can relate to, which is sense of smell. The great mystery of how does the sense of smell work? Smell has been regarded for a long time as sort of our most mysterious of senses, because it was very hard to understand how it is that we humans can identify 10,000 different scents, and probably other mammals can recognize a lot more. In a broad way, everybody knew how smell worked. You inhale and the chemical vapors in the air go up, and they would interact with something, the cells inside your nose, and those would send a signal mm-hmm. to your brain, and they would tell you what you were smelling. But, of course, that glosses over at least a couple of great big mysteries. How is it that those sensor cells recognize the individual chemical vapors, and then how it is that the brain makes sense of those signals? And Axel and Buck, they actually contributed very much to both of those by identifying a group of 1,000 cells, 1,000 genes that represent the receptor molecules for all of those different scents that we recognize.
1,000 genes.
That's right. It's 1,000 genes, and each one of these receptor cells hanging down at the top of your nose expresses just one of them.
Wow.
Yes. And so what happens is that then basically when the vapors are in your nose, the vapors will interact with a certain subset of all of those cells, and each one of those then sends its distinctive signal back to a different sort of relay station in the brain, which helps to sort out the combinations of these different signals that are coming out. Then that information gets sent to the higher centers in the cortex of the brain, and that's how you start to recognize that distinctive smell of the Krispy Kreme donut.
Yeah, it is a distinctive, and how you remember the smells too. I mean, there must be some interesting pathways how you can recall it years later.
That's right. There are a number of interesting mysteries about that, but it's probably not a coincidence that the olfactory bulb of the first part of our brain that is involved in detecting smell, that it's so closely related or so closely positioned, I should say, to some of the areas around the hippocampus that are involved with the association of memory. Scent is a very, very important scent. We humans, mm-hmm. we rely a lot on our vision and our hearing, but most other animals depend much, much more on their sense of smell.
I'd say if we can get a phone call or two here. Sundar in Tucson. Hi, Sundar.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be on the show, and congratulations on a fantastic show.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My question is, how long does it take for some of these exciting discoveries to get into high school and college textbooks?
That's a good question.
That is a good question, and really, it's a pretty varied answer. I mean, for example, that work that was being done in physics, that as Ira, as you pointed out, that was done back in the 70s. Quite frankly, you would have already found that in most textbooks, and in fact, a lot of this work is really already in textbooks. Maybe the smell receptor work, which was really only done, I think, around 1990, and subsequently, some of that may be too recent to get into some textbooks.
You know, the history is full of stuff like that. Speaking of another Columbia guy, Eric Kandel's work with aplasia.
Absolutely.
That many years before he got recognition for that.
That's right.
And it was standard stuff in textbooks for years before he even got the prize for that.
The Nobel Prize is really sort of like a great sort of retrospective honor. By the time somebody wins the Nobel Prize, everybody already knows it's a great contribution.
And the interesting thing about the Nobel Prize is that you have to be alive, right?
Yes, that's right. There are no post-mortem awards. And there have been some interesting cases of people who sometimes have been overlooked. I guess Rosalind Franklin is maybe the most notorious of those, in that a lot of people felt that she should have shared in the prize for the discovery of the double helix along with Watson and Crick. But she had died, I think, 3 years before that prize was awarded. And so, in fact, Watson and Crick shared that with another one of her co-workers.
Wilkins.
Yes.
Who died today?
Did he?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just there was news of it who died. He died. I think it was today, right? Yeah, he died today. And, of course, you're almost also limited to three, right? You only
can
share it by three.
That's
so
right.
So she couldn't be, you know, even if they wanted to, they had sort of forced her out of being able to share it. And of course, there's a million and a third?
I think
or
these days
like
it's about 1.3 million. That's right. I think it's officially, it's 10 million Swedish kroner. But I think at the current rate of exchange, that's about 1.3 million.
And then they have the elaborate ceremony.
Yes.
In Stockholm.
Yeah. Right? That's right. Everyone I know who's attended that has always said that, it takes pomp and circumstance to its greatest level.
I was fortunate enough to go to one of them.
Really?
Yeah. And they gave out wonderful chocolate coins. Actually, the medal, they make it into a wonderful chocolate medal that they give out, but among other things. But it really is a lot of pomp and circumstance, and it's an opportunity to see all the Nobel Prize winners are invited back, and you see them all in one spot.
No, that's.
I think it's the kind of thing that we should televise, like we do the Academy Awards, and you can put out a red carpet, And
I think a lot of people would find it a somewhat less telegenic event than, say, the Academy Awards, but it's a very good idea for promoting science.
It's a great idea. 1-800-989-8299. Let's go to the phones if I can reach it. Ted, is it Hamburg, Michigan?
Yes.
Hi.
Hamburg, Michigan.
Quickly.
I'm about to change history, and I expect to get the Nobel Peace Prize in the future. I'm going to make us energy independent next year, and I was wondering how long you might expect before the world might notice and give me such a prize.
It's always, of course, hard to guess, but I'm guessing in this case a very long time.
Well, speaking of which, and I'm not equating with this, you hear stories about perpetual motion machines all the time, and certainly,
you'll notice you hear about those from people other than really good physicists.
But does point out that you have to be. There is an elaborate nominating process.
Oh
right?
yes, it's many aspects of the Nobel Prize, the nomination process are sort of cloaked in mystery. It's very hard to know who all the nominees really are in a given year.
And I guess you can't nominate yourself. I don't know.
I don't believe so. I think it would be taken seriously.
But you have to be have enough friends that will nominate you, enough people who like your work.
Right. But as we said, by the time you get this prize, everybody knows that you're great.
It's true. John Rennie, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
Talking with John Rennie, editor-in-chief of Scientific American Magazine. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the spaceship, the Ansari X Prize that was given out this week. Does it open the future to commercialization of space? Would you like to take a ride in a spaceship? Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.